You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. You're in Washington, D.C.?
I am. It's very hot and very humid.
You know, it's funny. It's that way here, too. And I'm on the Eastern Seaboard as well, and maybe that explains the whole thing. I've been in Washington this summer, and it's no picnic. My heart goes out to you. So let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Jennifer Cavanaugh. You've never been a guest on the podcast, but I've long been aware of your work at Defense Priorities, which is a think tank in Washington, and where you are a senior fellow and director of military analysis. You were previously at Carnegie, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You've written for Foreign Affairs, New York Times, Foreign Policy, and places like that. And you teach at Georgetown. And I want to talk about weapons today, particularly as they relate to a couple of wars that people have probably heard of. One is in Ukraine. One is in Iran. The Iran war is in abeyance, apparently, although there hasn't been, as we record this, unless you've got late-breaking news, any kind of formally agreed-upon cessation of the most recent round of hostilities. And there are a couple of connections between the two wars. A few weeks ago, people were worried that they might become a single giant war. Ukraine had attacked an Iranian ship that was actually quite a long way from Ukraine's shores, so that drew notice. Since then, they seem to have patched things up, and Ukraine seems to have signaled that, you know, Iran shouldn't take it personally. It didn't represent kind of a big strategic initiative or anything. Another connection, but I do want to ultimately get your thoughts on whether there's a chance that these wars could have some unfortunate kind of synergy in the long run of that kind. In other words, kind of become a bigger single war. But there's also the issue of weapons. Ukraine is getting pummeled by Russian missile strikes now, and the prospects for getting much relief in the form of American-provided defensive missiles seem slim, in part because apparently we've used so many of them in the course of this Iran war. There was a story in the Washington Post this week that Trump lost his temper with Hegseth because, as they put it, let's see, at a Camp David meeting, Trump demanded answers from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth on why he had apparently been misled on extreme munitions shortages that now threaten to limit military options with Iran. That's both defensive and there's been quite an expenditure of offensive weapons. But anyway, this gives people some sense of the landscape, I hope, to cover. Before I ask you specific questions, do you have any just general reactions to anything I said or what part of it you find most in need of discussion?
Well, I do think that talking about what it actually means that the U.S. has a munition shortage and what that means for U.S. foreign policy and how we got to this situation is a really important discussion. So I think digging into that is valuable. You know, my view is that the munition shortage is both more serious and less serious than the press makes it out to be. I think it's less serious in the sense that it to me, it's not the limiting factor on the U.S. war in Iran. But it does have really significant long-term implications for U.S. foreign policy. Like, that's where the real cost is in terms of strategic flexibility going forward. And then I think your point about the risks of the two wars merging is an important one. You know, my view is that they do not have to merge, that if they did, it would be a choice. And I found the Ukrainian strike on the Iranian ship to be quite escalatory. And really a play by Ukraine to suggest, well, look, we're helping you fight your war, so you should also
right.
be more involved in our war. And to me, that was very dangerous. And I'm hoping that the reason that Ukraine backed off right after that was that the Trump administration sent a signal that this was not a game they wanted to play. But whatever the cause, I'm glad that they've backed off it, but it's definitely something to watch.
Yeah. I mean, I worry that, you know, there's been this narrative that Ukraine has, if not turned the tide, although there has been that narrative, at least kind of got Russia on its back foot. There's a stalemate. I see a certain amount of evidence that actually Ukraine's in more trouble than that narrative suggests. And I worry that Ukraine might go to extremes to get the U.S. more deeply or Western Europe more deeply invested in ways that could expand the zone of conflict in one sense or another, draw, you know, provoke a Russian response that, or NATO's involvement could get Russia to do something that, you know, leads NATO to get more directly involved. A lot of ways you can imagine that happening. Before we get back to the weapons issue, what is your quick take on the turning the tide narrative? What do you think that this, how do things look for Ukraine at the moment?
Well, I think that Ukraine has had success in its long-range strike campaign against Russian targets, clearly, both oil refineries and these like Amazon-like Wildberry warehouses. Mm-hmm. And certainly this has made the war feel different, both from like externally looking at what's happening. And I think inside of Moscow too, now the costs are much more apparent to the Russian population. There was a period where there were pretty long gas lines in Russia across the country, although that seems to have stabilized. They've also, I think Ukraine has had success in its like mid-range strike campaign, which has damaged Russia's logistics and slowed down its ability to gain territory on the front line. But I think this narrative that it's turned the tide is mostly based on propaganda. I think we hear a lot about any success that Ukraine has and very little about the continuing successes that the Russian side has. Russia does continue to gain strategically important territory in the Donbass. They are gaining positions that, if they can consolidate them, will give them a much easier road to taking the rest of Donetsk, not this year probably, but possibly next year. And they have a real advantage in this. If we're going to have like a war of long-range strikes, Russia has the advantage because it can produce something like 120 ballistic missiles a month. And Ukraine has basically no air defenses right now. And I think in the Western press, we get this narrative that Russia's hitting residential buildings. And certainly some of Russia's missiles go awry and do hit civilian targets. But at least the last round of strikes hit mostly things like industrial warehouses and logistics factories and things that are supporting Ukraine's war effort, as well as their energy infrastructure, which still hasn't recovered from last year's last winter. So my view is that, yes, Ukraine has gained a little bit of momentum, but Russia still has structural advantages, both in terms of the depth of its industrial base, its ability to generate more manpower. And these structural advantages ultimately will swing the momentum back in Russia's favor. And I really worry about Ukraine's ability to survive this winter. And I think that you see signs coming from Zelensky that he does too. You know, just over the past couple of days, his messaging about needing more patriots, starting to blame the West for withholding these when they really exist. I don't actually think that these stockpiles exist. He's asking countries to choose between defending themselves and defend Ukraine, and they're always going to pick themselves. And these reshuffling, constant reshuffling in his government, like to me, this suggests that he's also worried about this. So, you know, my view is that Ukraine has a lot more struggles and a lot more challenges than we see in the Western media. And the next 6 months could be critical, depending on how things go, especially in this long-range strike campaign.
Yeah, and Ukraine's decision to kind of, you know, expand the realm of its offensive more deeply into Russia, hit more infrastructure, including now these commercial warehouses. I mean, Ukraine certainly has the right to do that. It's the country that was invaded, but it does seem to me it has had the effect of Russia, you know, expanding its own strikes of that kind. And that's a game that Russia wins in the long run, right? And so I can see, I mean, I think the new Ukraine campaign hit infrastructure deep inside Russia has been successful, you said, along a number of lines, including selling the narrative that, hey, Ukraine's in this, we can do this thing, which I think they want to sell in the West. But it does seem to me that it has ultimately made them more vulnerable and put them in kind of a worse situation, especially in light of the apparent shortage of defensive missiles, which you will get back to. Do you think to some extent what Russia, the extent to which Russia is now ravaging Ukraine with missiles, is to some extent a response to this kind of shift of strategy on Ukraine's part?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Russian perception is that Ukraine and Europe are raising the stakes. And so Russia also must raise the stakes. They see escalation as the only option. And they have two ways that they can escalate. They can escalate inside Ukraine and they can escalate towards Europe. Escalating in Ukraine means more missiles and different types of missiles. So I've seen some reports that Russia is now expanding the types of missiles and munitions that it's using inside Ukraine, things that it hadn't used before. Like we have this sense that Russia has been fighting this like total war against Ukraine, but actually they have held back a lot of things that they could have applied. And so I think we're seeing them starting to apply increasing types of weapons and more powerful weapons. And escalating towards Europe, I think, you know, an increasing scope of hybrid attacks. Like, I don't think we're going to see Russia invade the Baltic states, like some people suggest, but things like industrial facilities in Europe blowing up, or more drone incursions, or sabotage, Russian Shadow Fleet tankers having suspicious environmental catastrophes on the coasts of European nations. Like, these things are all possible. And I think that Russia sees its only option here as escalation, and it will do that. And I also think we see an amazing amount of parallelism between the two campaigns. So, you know, Ukraine starts striking Russian oil refineries, and Russia starts hitting Ukrainian gas stations. We see Ukraine start hitting Wildberry factories, and now we see Russia hitting the same types of online distribution facilities inside Ukraine. Ukraine starts hitting Russian Shadow Fleet tankers in the Black Sea. And then Russia starts hitting all the ports and basically blockading and shutting down Ukraine's grain exports. So we see this like parallelism that every time Ukraine escalates, Russia also escalates towards the same types of targets.
And Russia is a bigger country with more stuff and more people. And that seems to me Ukraine's problem. I mean, you know, it seems like all of these escalations that Russia matches wind up being asymmetrical in that sense, in effect, right?
Right, in effect, yeah. So, you know, anything Ukraine can do, Russia can do better, right? There's that right. Like old song. And I think that's what you see. Is yes, Ukraine can keep escalating, keep expanding targets. It will eventually get more powerful missiles, but anything it can deal out, Russia can deal out back many fold. Yeah. And I think that's the challenge. That's the challenge that Ukraine faces.
I mean, in terms of munitions, you know, Ukraine is getting help from Western Europe and the U.S. and can in principle get more, and maybe it will. And let's turn to that. Of course, this is also one of the things that leads to concerns about the thing expanding in the direction of Western Europe. One more quick question on that. Of the things you listed that Russia might do in response, how many, if any, do you think they're already doing? Like, I guess that would be mainly in the form of sabotage. They're not doing anything super overt in the way of retaliating against Western Europe, but every once in a while something happens, somebody gets poisoned or something weird happens, and people say maybe that's Russia sending a message. Do you think there's been much of that in Western Europe?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a few suspicious like industrial plant fires that I've wondered, like, you know, is this like an accident or not? We have seen recently an increasing rate, I think, of missiles that end up in Poland, drone incursions, things like that, that are, you know, pretty minor, but cause a lot of anxiety along the frontline states and in European countries. There's a report about a potential attempted attack on a Ukrainian cargo plane that was flying from Germany. With a lot of these reports, it's hard to know like how much is actually like something that was perpetrated by Russia as part of a hybrid campaign, and how much is something else that has nothing to do with it. But certainly, I do think we've seen an increase of these sort of suspicious activities that suggest that Russia is pushing forward with its hybrid campaign. I agree. They won't do anything attributable. They'll stay in this gray zone space. But I think over time, like what that gray zone space includes may expand. So we're getting to something that is actually quite kinetic, that 5 years ago we might have considered an act of war, but now we lump it into gray zone. And I think that's sort of the status quo going forward.
Okay. And as for the defensive missile problem, so I mean, Russia, I read, has sent like 650, this year, 650 missiles have targeted Ukraine. A very low percentage are now being intercepted. On some days, Russia will hit them with 28, 30 missiles, and Ukraine will intercept one or two. And part of the problem, apparently, is that we have used, in the course of, well, both Iran wars, the one that Israel started and we joined about a year ago, and the one that we and Israel started more recently, have been very heavy on the use of offensive and defensive, but maybe most consequentially, the anti-missile missiles. And apparently, just this last war exhausted at least half of our entire supply of Patriots and Thads, which I gather are the two most important kinds of battlefield defensive missiles. And that leaves us with, you would know the number, I guess it's somewhere in the vicinity of, on one side or another, of 1,000, and we, I think our sense is that that's not enough for us to give many at all to Ukraine. So far, are those facts more or less right?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's about 800 or so Patriot missiles and 250 or so Thad missiles, mm-hmm. Maybe less Thad missiles. There's been some reporting that that situation may be worse. The reason that these missiles are so important is that they're the best for intercepting ballistic missiles. Ballistic missiles are the hardest to intercept because of their flight path and because they move so quickly. Mm. And so Patriots and Thads are basically the only types of air defense missiles that can reliably intercept them. The Europeans have some systems that they're trying to get developed to the point where they could supplement. But right now, they're just not really that effective. Ukraine is trying to build one. But right now, this is basically it. And so I think the concern is if you go through, 50 or 60% of your ballistic missile interceptors in a 6-week war with Iran, can you really afford to give away more when you also are trying to make sure that the United States is prepared for other types of crises? And the big one people point to is a war with China over Taiwan or something else. Now, clearly, 1,000 air defense missiles for ballistic missiles is not sufficient. China has over 3,000 ballistic missiles of different ranges. Mm-hmm. So clearly, the United States is not prepared for a war with China. And so given that, can you afford to give any more away to Ukraine? And when Zelensky was in D.C. for Lindsey Graham's funeral, I guess it was last week, he was asking for something like 300 Patriot missiles. Well, that's almost half of what the U.S. has left. Mm-hmm. And the stockpiles of European countries are even smaller. So I think the sense here is that the U.S. can't afford to give them away, or if they can afford to give them away, it's in such small numbers, like 25 or something like that. But what does that do for Ukraine? Not that much.
That's like one day. I mean, yeah. Really.
Exactly.
Right?
So what the U.S. can afford to give just is simply not enough to help Ukraine in a meaningful way. And this is the conundrum, is what do you do when you simply don't have the ballistic missiles interceptors to give to defend Ukraine? Now, to me, this seems like an obvious moment where we should be saying, like, this war has to stop. We need diplomacy. Like, we need to start talking about what concessions are required to get this war to end now before the winter starts. But mm-hmm. that doesn't seem to be the conversation that's happening in Europe or really in D.C.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard from some commentators who pay more attention to Russia than and its perspective and what Putin's thinking than maybe, a lot of mainstream outlets. But I've heard from some of them that Putin's view is, he's been pretty clear about what a peace deal would have to have from his point of view. And he feels that the problem is that we haven't paid attention to him, or we've been inconsistent. We've made agreements or informal agreements. I heard that he felt that at the Anchorage summit, I think that's where it was with him and Trump, he had some grievance about what was said there, what he thought Trump did or was going to do or something. I mean, do you have a clear, has he been clear on what it would take to get a peace deal? Do you have a clear vision of what he's thinking in that regard?
Well, I think that Putin's aims since the beginning of the war have been pretty consistent. I think there has been some shifting in terms of increasing flexibility on the Russian side in terms of what's required for the ceasefire versus what has to be addressed at a political settlement. Mm-hmm. But I think the core things that are required right now for a ceasefire are, number one, commitment from the United States and other Western nations that Ukraine will not be a member of NATO. Number two, commitment that there will not be NATO forces in Ukraine in peacetime or ever any time in the future. And that would include things like overflight of Ukrainian territory, things like that. And number three, a solution to this question of control of the Donbass and the rest of Donetsk. There's like 20% of Donetsk that Russia has not claimed by military force. And so some solution on that, which would give Russia like, you know, de facto control over it. There, I think there is some flexibility. Doesn't have to necessarily be Russian military personnel. It could be their like National Guards type, like Rosgardia. So there is flexibility on sort of what that looks like, but it would have to be Russian administrative control according to Putin's demands. Now, most of the other things, like conversations about Ukraine's military capabilities in the future, conversations about language rights, conversations about the European security architecture, like those are things that are important. Ultimately, this war isn't really about Ukraine. It's about Ukraine's alignment and the broader European security architecture. But I think those other bigger picture things are things that could be discussed after the initial ceasefire. But those three things are the things I've heard are the core sort of like, and what I see as the core things that must be addressed before a ceasefire can be reached. You know, I do agree that there have been misunderstandings. I think that there was a sense on the Russian side that there was an agreement at Anchorage or an understanding that the United States would pressure Ukraine to make that final, that third set of concessions on territory to withdraw from the rest of Donetsk. I think it. I think on the U.S. side, there was a set, whatever understanding was reached was less than a commitment. They didn't feel like they made an agreement. It was sort of an idea, and it didn't end up working out because the United States didn't have the leverage or the will to push Ukraine to give up that territory. I think now there's an agreement on both sides that we need a new approach, that the whatever the spirit of Anchorage is gone, and we need to sort of start over and have a reset. I think we've heard some comments from Rubio that maybe in the next couple of weeks, there'd be opportunities to reset and restart this diplomacy. I think that would be a good thing. As I said, I think this is the time to like end the war. But I think the challenge is that the U.S. doesn't have a lot of diplomatic space for dealing with the Ukraine-Russia problem until it addresses the Iran problem. Especially when its lead negotiators are the same two people on both conflicts. So I'm hopeful that something will, you know, come of a new push in August, but I guess I'm a little bit skeptical of whether the Iran situation will be resolved enough to create the space for a serious diplomatic effort on the Ukraine front.
So your account of Anchorage suggests that Trump actually was okay, or signaled to Russia that he was okay with saying Ukraine will never be part of NATO and there won't be NATO troops in Ukraine, because that's a lot of presidents would find that a politically pretty forbidding thing to agree to. And I suspect that a fairly big part of the foreign policy establishment would rain down criticism on Trump if he did that. But I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about that. But is your understanding that Trump was okay with that part?
Yeah, I mean, I think the current administration has been pretty clear that the end of this war will not be Ukraine and NATO, and that the United States does not support Ukraine's NATO membership at this time. I think that's what the administration has been clear on since day one. I mean, Hegseth basically said that in his Brussels in 2025 in February. So to me, I think that that's fine. And I think this question of NATO troops in Ukraine, I mean, ultimately, I think the Trump administration's goal is an end to this war that minimizes U.S. commitments. The U.S., I don't think Trump wants long-term commitments to Ukraine, but I don't think Trump really cares about the details. There is this discussion about the coalition of the willing, about whether or not there would be European forces in Ukraine after the war ends. I think the U.S. position on this is sort of like, well, if Europe wants to do it, okay. But I think there's a recognition that Europe won't do it unless they have a U.S. backstop. because they'll be worried that those troops will be attacked and then they'll be at war with Russia on their own, because Article 5 technically wouldn't cover an attack on European forces in Ukraine if Ukraine's not in NATO. And I don't think the U.S. is willing to give that backstop. Like, so far, I don't think they've given the assurances. So ultimately, I think sort of through a roundabout way, the Trump administration is signaling that it would be fine saying, like, no NATO troops. Well, certainly it won't be NATO troops inside Ukraine. I think they're willing to kind of let the Europeans have their fantasy about putting forces in Ukraine. But I think most people understand that that's, like, not realistic after the war.
Yeah. Well, if I were Putin, I might try to, like, work a little harder toward getting a deal before Trump is replaced by a more Biden-esque president who's more reluctant to let go of the NATO thing. But what do I know? So on the missiles, okay, so, you know, when you ask, like, okay, why is our stock of defensive and to some extent offensive missiles, especially like cruise missiles, you know, dangerously depleted? People generally say, mentioned a couple of things you mentioned, like, well, China, we might need them against China. Although, as you said, we need apparently more of them than we have if we had some kind of war with China. And, you know, they say, well, the Middle East may flame up again. We may need more of them to protect our troops in Israel. And so on. But I have a question about these, like, Patriots and Thads. Is there a very plausible scenario in which they're actually used to protect Americans in America? I mean, I recognize that if we send troops to these various parts of the world for reasons that aren't always clear to me, they may need defending. But is there a scenario where we actually need them for national security in the strict sense of the term?
I mean, Patriots, not really. I mean, the question gets to, do we expect a conventional attack on the United States? Now, my answer is we know. Like, what country is going to launch conventional missiles at the United States? It's not one of our neighbors. It's not going to be Mexico or Canada.
I don't see that happening, no.
I mean, Russia and China have the capability to do that. I just don't see that as a likely scenario in which they're firing conventional missiles at the U.S. homeland, either whether it's, like, you know, from warships off the U.S. coast or from their own territory. This seems to be like a very implausible situation. You know, it's certainly possible that the United States and Russia could, or the United States and China could, get into a regional war. But and if that did escalate to attacks on the homeland, my sense is that they would, you know, by that point, we'd be sort of in the nuclear situation.
And presumably we would have used a lot of the Patriots in the course of the escalation. I mean, presumably this is something that begins around Taiwan and we do what we can. And by the time it goes global,
that's my sense. By the time it goes global, you're already in like a really bad situation where you're not worried about whether you have THAAD interceptors. And also, the U.S. does have other types of air and missile defense to defend the homeland. Like, at that point, I think they're building towards a situation where you'd be working much more with like a more advanced set of air defense. And I know there's definitely investment in the United States in trying to bolster like air defense of homeland. But my understanding is that that is not based on trying to buy more Patriots or more THAADs. Like, these Patriot and THAAD are really systems built for sort of these regional conflicts. I mean, we have 8 THAADs right now. 4 of them are in the Middle East. So, like, we're not, these are
like four of big deployments of clusters of THAADs, you mean?
Yeah. So we have 8 total systems, and 4 of them right now are in the Middle East. That's not consistent with the U.S. national defense strategy in terms of how it prioritizes regions. But yeah, could THAADs play a role in homeland defense? A little bit. But to me, that's not really a realistic scenario, because the scenarios in which you end up with a Russia or China firing conventional ballistic missiles at the U.S. homeland, you have so many other problems, and you've probably already used all your THAAD missiles.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if those boats were bombing in the Caribbean turn out to be carrying like ballistic missiles, but I'm kind of doubting that. So having trouble coming up with a scenario. So you are of the view that actually, you know, if you really wanted to pursue this Iranian war further, you know, we're not so depleted that we couldn't do that. In any event, I gather the Trump administration, for whatever reason, doesn't have much of an appetite for persisting in the war. And I don't know, I guess it's maybe, my guess is it's a combination of, I mean, look, let's face it, Trump, if he does deplete the defensive missiles further, he'll catch a certain amount of political hell for it, right? I mean, this is perceived by the foreign policy establishment as like a problem. Not that he's shown, you know, always a willingness to indulge the sentiments of the foreign policy establishment, but it comes and goes. But I gather, don't you think more deeply than that? It's just that maybe he's come to understand this is a pretty resilient regime. They are willing to escalate if necessary to defend what they think of as their core interests. And one of those seems to be control of the Strait of Hormuz. And so it's just kind of a losing game. It's just not clear that he, it's not clear how he gets anything that looks like more of a win than he can get now, which of course isn't something that looks very much like a win. But what do you think is driving his current attitude toward the war, which seems to be, you know, yeah, we really aren't interested in continuing this thing?
Well, I think there's two factors. I think one is certainly there is concern about munition stockpiles. I think, you know, as you said, my general assessment is that if they really wanted to keep up with some kind of military campaign, do a couple more weeks of escalation, they could. They have the offensive weapons to do it. And Iran's rate of missile fire is down from the beginning of the war. So a lot of the expenditure of weapons were in the first couple of weeks, even the first couple of, the first days when Iran was firing missiles at a much higher rate. Now, they're still able to fire ballistic missiles. We've seen that just in July. There were deaths of U.S. service members from ballistic missile strikes. So they're still able to do it, but the rate is much lower. And so you're going to expend defensive weapons at a much lower rate. Israel's also not involved right now. So if they stay out, it's likely that Iran won't attack Israel. So you're not wasting weapons also defending Israeli territory. So you would burn through more defensive weapons probably at a slower rate. So the United States could continue to fight if it wanted to. But I think there is concern that doing that really erodes the U.S. ability to respond to any other crisis anywhere. And I don't think a war over Taiwan is likely in the near term. I don't think China's going to move on Taiwan in the near term. But the question for policymakers is over, do you want to accept that risk? Do you want to accept this position where the United States is simply unable to protect other locations or to pursue other U.S. interests? But the other factor that's playing into this is like, what do you achieve with more bombing? Like maybe you would be willing to expend those munitions if you thought you could get what you wanted at a reasonable price. But I think the other message that's been coming out of the Pentagon is, or at least according to these, you know, quote unquote leaks, is that like more bombing isn't going to achieve the goal. There are significant limitations to what the U.S. can achieve with more bombing. Like it's very hard to find these mobile missile launchers. They move around, they're underground. The U.S. can bury them for a couple of days and then the Iranians dig them out and start using them again. So it's very difficult to erode permanently Iran's ability to shoot missiles and drones into the Strait. Iran has big advantages. It controls the geography like right near the Strait, and you can't take away the advantage of geography is permanent. You can't do anything about that. So more military force isn't actually going to achieve what the administration wants, which is to reopen the Strait. There's no military path to reopen the Strait unless Trump is willing to accept significant amounts of risk and probably, you know, a massive air and naval campaign in which probably at least one or two U.S. ships will sustain significant damage, in which multiple aircraft could be shot down, in which you might need to put ground forces in. Like, that's the cost of trying to militarily open the strait, and Trump's not willing to take that. So at the current rate of bombing, you're not going to achieve anything. So if you're not going to achieve anything and you're going to waste weapons that you might need for some other campaign, it just simply doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sort of the calculation here, is that, you know, military force isn't going to achieve what Trump wants at this level of effort. And the amount of effort that would be required is a level of risk that he's not willing to take because of the U.S. casualties and the political blowback that would come with that.
Mm-hmm. Have we seen kind of the best that Iran can do in terms of weapon deployment? I mean, you hear about these things that I think they have used a little, these hypersonic ballistic missiles that as they approach the target can engage in invasive maneuvers or something and are apparently very hard to shoot down. I guess they've used them a little, but is there a sense? I mean, my sense is that Iran, possibly more than America, has been pretty calibrated in its escalation and its escalation signaling. That sometimes it's striking something just as a signal and fine if they do some damage, but that's not the main point. And I've wondered, are they like holding something in reserve? And I have a related question. It's a definitional question about ballistic missiles. I mean, so ballistic missiles, they go way high up and they move fundamentally in an arc and rely for the most part for their ultimate, you know, targeting on the initial trajectory, and some of them, you know, you can't aim more precisely, but that's not definitionally true, right? Like some ballistic missiles do, as they approach the target, have some degree of smartness in them. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I think more advanced ballistic missiles have like seekers that are able to adjust if required. And also, mm-hmm. I think over time, adversaries can learn how to adjust their flight path to avoid air defenses and to be more accurate. So yeah, I think as missiles get more precise and more advanced, you're able to put more advanced technology into the targeting systems, which allows for some adjustment as they move towards a target.
Mm-hmm. Because I've wondered if Iran has ballistic missiles that have this hypersonic, by the way, as you know, doesn't just mean supersonic, fast and speed of sound. It means like several times as fast as the speed. They're like really fast. and apparently they can kind of dance as they approach the target. And I've wondered, I don't know what the range of precision is, but I've wondered whether that means that in principle, even though we are, I gather, keeping our ships at quite some distance from Iran, right? Like, for the most part, a few hundred miles, except when every once in a while we get assertive about Hormuz or something. I've wondered if even there, they are not in principle vulnerable. If Iran really wanted to expend some of its, most sophisticated weapons and possibly most precious weapons, whether those ships would be vulnerable, but is that not the case?
Yeah, I mean, so Iran's military capabilities have been degraded over the course of the war, but also in some ways gotten better over the course of the war. It's learned how to target better. It's getting help from the Russians and the Chinese on intelligence sharing. It is getting more advanced technology and help reconstituting its military, and it's especially its missile capabilities and air defenses over as the war has continued. And so this is allowing it to be more precise and more accurate with its targeting. Now, it's actually done quite well. During the opening days of the war, its campaign was quite smart. It went after U.S. bases. It went after U.S. radars and the sensor network that underlies the U.S. and Israeli air defense network across the region, mm-hmm. which meant that then it could be much more effective at evading targets. Hitting ships is hard because ships move. You need really precise intelligence and satellite help to mm-hmm. aim your missiles at ships. That's why there are like special like anti-ship missiles that are built to help hit mobile targets. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of Iran's ballistic missile capabilities are like not anti-ship missiles.
Okay.
But I do think they have the capability to do this. They haven't. Partly, I think, because like it would be a lot of effort to get the right intelligence, the right satellite data, and then you'd have to expend probably more missiles to make sure you hit the ship. To actually do damage to a really big Navy ship, you'd have to hit it with like 4 or 8 missiles. So if you're already operating from like constraints on your military capacity, that's probably not the best use of your military power. But it's like not impossible, certainly. And certainly they've shot drones at Navy ships. Now, obviously hurting a Navy ship with drones takes even more, but it's not that they don't have the capabilities. I mean, I think they've been quite smart in choosing how to use the capabilities that they have to inflict the most costs on the United States and on its Gulf partners.
So these would be anti-ship missiles if they did try this. They wouldn't be these hypersonic.
I mean, you could use normal, like, you know, target. You can use missiles that are supposed to hit stationary targets against mobile ones. It's not like you can't. It's just that it's harder.
We hope for the best.
Yeah, it's harder. I mean, the reason that the anti-ship missiles are more advanced is because they have much more of this technology to like seek out targets, right? If you're a moving target, you want to have a missile that can adjust in case your target moves along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they may also be reluctant. Like if you really did major damage to an aircraft carrier, that would, from Iran's point of view, have potential upsides and downsides. It could put Trump in a position where he felt he had to really escalate, you know, to save face or something. Who knows? But so do you have a sense for where the Iran thing is heading? As we record this, there's talk that they're going to work out this Strait of Hormuz issue. And I mean, first of all, my understanding is that the memorandum of understanding had kind of worked it out. Like my read was, although the U.S. didn't want it to say this explicitly, there was the understanding that Iran is going to have control of the strait. They're not going to charge tolls for at least 60 days, according to it. But there wasn't some statement of principle about the free flow of traffic, as I recall. It just said Iran, within 30 days, will restore traffic to its pre-war level or do its best to do that or something. And U.S. forces will, quote, withdraw from the area. I mean, everything about it signaled awareness that the Strait of Hormuz was Iran's thing now, but they did have to restore the flow of traffic and they couldn't charge tolls. And then I gather it was sometime after they agreed on that, that the U.S. decided to sponsor something that Iran was pretty clearly going to find threatening to its control of the strait, which was they set up this thing with Oman and the UN, I guess, to sanction the movement of ships through a separate route that didn't involve checking in with Iran, which Iran wanted. They just wanted all the ships to check in with them. So my read is the MOU had the Strait of Hormuz issues settled at least for 60 days while they worked out negotiations of a more permanent situation, and that at some point Trump decided to do something that Iran was pretty much guaranteed to see as provocative, and at that point Iran did what you might think they do, which is attack the ships that were trying to evade Iranian control. Is that your read?
Yeah, I mean, I think the original MOU had this, you know, the fifth point, which was very ambiguous about sort of what the state of the strait would be. And I think it gave Iran some leeway, said that the countries in the Gulf would work together to have a permanent solution, didn't explicitly authorize tolls, but also didn't explicitly forbid tolls. But then I think what the U.S. did was to try to open this other route, right? To open this southern route closer to Oman to limit Iran's control. Iran saw this as a violation of the MOU. It saw it as interference. That was their motivation for returning to striking ships, because this was not consistent with their view of what the MOU said or of recognizing their control. I think the deal that seems to be like in play now, according to what we know, is that, you know, ships would use the Iranian route one on the way out, in, and the Omani route on the way out, or And there would be no tolls, at least for 60 days, and no fees.
So they're going to stick. They're going to stick with that part, apparently, I gather.
That seems to, I mean, I don't, it does, I'm hesitant to say anything's final till it's like, you know, actually agreed upon. But, you know, that seems to be what's being discussed now. Now, I think ultimately, in the long run, there will be some sort of like multilateral arrangement in the Strait. And it will be something that the Gulf states can live with. The U.S. may or may not have a big role in it. I think that ultimately, we're moving towards a world of more contested seas in which there will be fees and limitations on movement through choke points. Like this idea of freedom of navigation all the time, everywhere, underwritten by U.S. naval power, is sort of a post-World War II anomaly, not something that's consistent over the history of the world. And I think the U.S. has to sort of just acknowledge that this is the way things are moving. It's uncomfortable for the United States because even in the past, when the United States has gone into massive and made massive military blunders, they haven't really had to pay any like major long-term consequences. Certainly, these wars have been costly in terms of dollars. It's meant American lives lost. In theory, it's meant a loss of American power, but that never actually, like the U.S. was already so far ahead that it didn't matter. But now we're in a place where like, the United States stumbles into a massive, disastrous war. And the outcome is that the world will be changed in a way that is a negative. Like it is a negative for U.S. interests that the future of the world now will maybe be these, you know, fees and blocked choke points. But this is a consequence of making these types of military mistakes now that we're in a world where the balance of power has shifted. And, you know, the United States is still the most powerful military in the world, but in relative terms, it is weaker and no longer has the dominance that it used to.
Yeah. I definitely want to get into that. And I have a contrarian take on whether this, on balance, this outcome would be bad for U.S. interests, but we can get to that. But to sum up on it sounds like what the deal that we're headed for now. And Iran says they're just negotiating it with Oman and not talking to the U.S. And the U.S. says, no, they're begging us. but whatever, it sounds like the deal they're headed to is basically just a restoration of the original understanding with what looks to me like kind of a fig leaf that America can hide behind, which is that now they can say, well, Oman is involved. That's what we wanted. We wanted Oman to be involved. But of course, the truth is Iran is running this whole show. I mean, you know, Iran is not a country that lives in fear of the awesome power of Oman, you know. So this is an Iran operation, and the agreement is: well, Oman will check the ships on the way out, Iran on the way in. It is essentially the same thing that Trump agreed to, or at least his people agreed to. You know, again, part of it was kind of between the lines, and I don't know how much he was aware of. But it sounds like this time he will have the brains to just stick with it, rather than do something that's obviously going to provoke an Iranian attack, right?
I mean, I think so. I think this arrangement would be a positive step forward in the sense that it would, at least for the next, you know, 60 days, formalize what that fifth article in the original MOU means for the next 60 days, which is, the problem with the original MOU, in my view, was that it was very clear that the Iranians and the United States had two very different reads on what the MOU said. And everyone seems
to- I'm not sure that I'm questioning that. I cannot believe that even Kushner and his real estate partner guy, what's the other guy's name? I cannot believe I can't believe any sentient being could read the MOU and not understand that Iran's clear understanding is they're controlling the Strait of Hormuz, A. And I seriously doubt that this wasn't explicitly discussed and it wasn't a problem of different countries reading ambiguous language differently. It was a problem of the U.S. not wanting to admit explicitly in writing in the MOU that this ceded control of Iran. I mean, honestly, is this administration so low IQ that nobody understood how Iran was going to look at this wording? I don't think so.
I would agree with you. That's not like exactly what I meant. I think they looked for ambiguous language that would allow Trump to claim a victory that they knew they could actually get. And they wanted this to be signed on his birthday. And so they rushed to get something that was like, you know, we could sell as a win. But then when the reality hit, when we saw what this actually meant, it was not acceptable. And so they decided to sort of see if they could try to wiggle their way out of it without restarting the war. So I would agree with you. So it's a positive in the sense that we have here maybe an agreement that would be explicit, so we could acknowledge. And yes, the U.S. could say, well, Oman is involved. It's a multilateral solution. Okay, fine. But I think the question is, what happens after those 60 days? Like, we're not talking about this toll-free system, as per the original MOU, was only for 60 days. In the long run, are we sure that that's going to be the case? Now, my view is that over time, Iran's leverage, like the value of holding the strait, will decline because countries are already building alternatives. They're building pipelines to divert oil away from the strait. So over time, the value of holding Hormuz will decline. So I think the U.S. should just basically be okay if there's if there's some kind of fee regime, I think you just accept it. The U.S. won't have to pay that much, doesn't rely that much. It will raise prices a little bit, but probably not as much as a war. And over time, that will decline. The only way to get around that is for the U.S. to effectively pay Iran to not charge by unfreezing assets and giving sanctions relief. And so, I don't know. The administration has been unwilling to tie those things to the strait because they want to tie them to the nuclear issue, which is what this war was originally about. But, once they started it and caused the second problem, now they're in a worse situation. They have the same cards and Iran has more.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, as you know, the format of this podcast is we talk for quite a while in the public portion of the podcast. And then we go into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. Link in the show notes or go to nonzero.org where you'll see a post for this conversation. And then you can watch or listen to the whole thing and set up your podcast feed so that that always happens automatically. You'll get a secret code that permits that. Before we go into overtime, Jennifer, I wanted to give you a chance to do any summing up, clarification, self-promotion. Well, let's start with self-promotion. where can people find your stuff? Or is there anything you've written lately that you particularly recommend? Are you on Twitter? If so, what's your handle? And so on.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's at J.E. Kavanaugh. My last name is like the Supreme Court Justice, but with no U. So if you're looking for me, that's how to spell it. I promote most of my work there. You can also find me on the Defense Priorities website, which is defensepriorities.org. All of my stuff is there. I think recently I've had a few pieces on this issue specifically. I had one in the American Conservative on Monday looking specifically at this issue of munitions shortage and in Responsible Statecraft looking at the Russia sanctions bill. And then about a week ago, I had a piece in the New York Times. It was about Asia, but tied to Iran in the sense it was looking at what U.S. mistakes in Iran have meant for the U.S. position in Asia. Mm-hmm. So those are my most recent things on the various.
Okay, well, I recommend them all. You do really good analysis. And so in overtime, I want to talk about this issue of the long-term changes that may flow from the war in Iran. And the question of, in the long run, how bad they really are for America. I'm gonna question whether on balance it won't be a healthy corrective for America. I'm gonna raise the possibility that it may be a healthy corrective for America and the world, but we'll see what you have to say about that. Thanks everybody who's followed us this far. Hope you follow us into overtime. And now we are going into overtime.